Well, but if the objective is, the argument is that what makes it a market solution is it will be in the interest of firms to market products that they accurately advertise as peanut free. This is not, by the way, an imaginary case. It so happens that somebody, the son of a friend of my wife's, is allergic to peanuts. And when she makes chocolate chip cookies that he is going to be one of the consumers of, she makes a point of going to the supermarket and getting the chocolate chips that are explicitly labeled, I don't know how they put it, but basically no chance at all of peanut contamination. So the question is, if you're going to argue, look, from the standpoint of the strongly believing vegan or Muslim or Jew, you can't compensate them for having violated their religious beliefs, right? Now, it depends on the religion. Some of them may say you're innocent if you didn't know, but...
Well, I think in that case, we go through this problem every day. You get the medical emergency, the physical harm can be pretty immediate, and not knowing that it's hard to get away from. But as moral and religious, what happens a lot of times for the 1-800 number there and all that. So we either have to listen from before somebody's done that research, provided the information, or we could always call and ask that number.
But couldn't you do the same thing for the physical? Couldn't the peanut allergy sufferers maintain a database of which foods do or don't have any peanut residue in them?
Sure. I suppose the harm of inadvertently taking it without having to call that number is the harm.
So in general, the opinion of people here is that if there is mandatory labeling, it ought to be limited to characteristics that have sizable negative effects of a sort that is sort of objectively verifiable rather than a sort that depends on the beliefs of the consumer. Is that the conclusion that both of you are arguing for, at least?
Yes. Even the modest baby has anti-labeling,
yeah, well, he's got a high-tech solution to that one, but I'm going to ignore that one because that eliminates too much of the problem.
So the issue with that product is that you actually have to post kind of testing stuff. Right? So if I find out that there's some random, isotope of carbon that can cause problems, so
yeah,
prepared to test on all their foods, and that would be a good cost.
Might be, yeah.
So to put that into post, to have the government post that kind of test on their foods.
Let me suggest a different possible approach to this issue, and that is for the government not to impose mandatory labeling, but to define language. In other words, suppose that the government says is you can label, you can cover whatever information you like, but we will define what different statements mean. So that we will say that if it says safe for allergic people, that means it contains none of the following list of things, which cover all of the common allergies we know about. If it says peanut free, that means it's got less than 1 in a billion parts of whatever the thing is. If it says calories per serving, it must include the weight of the serving, defined by weight, not volume, say. So you can imagine a case where people are entirely free not to give you information. All the government is doing is defining a language in order that you can know what the information is or isn't. And if there's a blank label there, caveat emptor. That they're just telling you we make no promises at all. It might make you fat. It might make you blow up and die or whatever. But you could then have some standard label. The government could say, well, safe for ordinary uses doesn't cover peanut allergies, but does cover cyanide. Anyway, it just seems to be an interesting alternative to think about, and I'm not sure if it's the right solution, but it's I like it better, I think, is one in which the government says what different statements mean and thus reduces the communication costs of giving information, but leaves people free to give or not give information as long as if they don't give you information, they make it clear they're not giving you new information. So that's an alternative possibility. And the one which, let me skip down a bit, because as I say, there was one that struck me as relevant to this question. Where did I put it? There we are. This is the vegan one. So some people are completely vegan, meaning they refuse to eat any animal products. If pig genes were used in a genetic modification process to make tomatoes plumper and richer, would the company have an obligation to label the tomatoes as containing pig products? If no label was required on the tomatoes, but the vegans found out about the pig genes, could they bring an action for failure to warn? Now, forget about what we've said so far, because I want to focus on a different question for a moment. And that is, why do the vegans care what's in it? Because it's relevant if you think about maybe something more likely than this particular example. One relevant question is, do you have a good reason to care? And that's what sort of the physical harm is one example where you do. So why does the vegan not want to eat meat? Because I think that's critical to whether or not this even passes the test of it's information they have a good reason to want. Any guess? Why? What are the reasons that a vegan might want not to eat meat? Yep.
Other than religious beliefs or something like that?
Religious beliefs would be one reason. He could be a Jain. I think that's the only...
The second time James was there.
What was the other one?
My friend mentioned it.
Yes. It's a Indian religion where the people wear gauze over their mouth to make sure they don't swallow insects and things. They have very strong views about not taking life, basically. What are the reasons?
Health concerns.
So then the question, then that really, in principle, comes down to the scientific question, whatever the health objections are to eating meat, do they also apply to eating the consequence of pig genes in your tomatoes? Yeah?
Are there also moral objections to actually harming animals? Even if the gene, you had extracted somehow.
Well?
Okay, if it was done through extraction,
I would
harm the animal.
I would have thought that the most common reason to be a vegetarian in general is that you don't like the idea of killing animals.
Yeah.
Well, no animals are killed for producing these tomatoes.
Well, it's a little upset, or upset by the fact that even like a pig in such a situation subject
to
this kind of test.
But you don't have to kill the pig. All you got to do is take a couple of cells out of it.
I'm sure it's difficult to be that activist to be subject to that.
Maybe. But it seems to me that if the objection is to killing animals, then the answer is there's no problem here. And that's a question worth asking in general, namely, if people object to something, why? Because in some of these exotic cases, like the ones we're talking about in biotech, the usual connections don't apply anymore. On the other hand, suppose it's human genes. I don't know if any of you followed the link that I had on the issues page, but it went to a fun paper that a student did in a previous year in which you had vegetables with human genes in them and people were saying that was terrible. Is that going to bother any of you? Let's carry take it a step further. Let's suppose it turns out that the particular form of meat that is most compatible to human metabolism is human meat. All right? But, of course, we don't want to kill anybody or anything, but that's all right. We're going to be far enough in the future so that you can take a cell, get the cell to reproduce itself, and just have, this is something that shows up in science fiction, not usually with human cells, but you would have sort of a growing chunk of meat, as it were, which you're feeding in the necessary nutrients, and you cut off slices and take them to the grocery store. Anybody object to the fact that the original cell came from a human being? Yes? No? What?
Of course.
I think most people would feel that way. Don't know how strong you would get. I would not, for example, suppose a drop of my blood fell into a glass of water. I don't think it would particularly freak me out to drink the water. After all, you do consume your own blood. You get a sore in your mouth, say, and some of it. So that doesn't seem to. And yet, when it gets to be human flesh, you start worrying about it, right? But all of which is going to illustrate some of the problems in defining what values are and therefore what people are or are not entitled to be, in some sense, protected against. Alright, those were the labeling ones, which as I say, aren't especially about biotech, though they come in with biotech, but I think are, in a sense, require more thought than they at first seem to, which is the reason to bring them up. Let me go on to previous year's student, which is actually going to be a related issue. Given that many fruits and vegetables are cloned, what line should be drawn with regard to labeling genetically modified food? For example, Whole Foods claim to sell only natural foods, yet sells seedless grapes and seedless watermelons. What do we know about seedless grapes and seedless watermelons with great confidence?
Should we
They were not grown from seed, right? I assume, have any of you ever heard of Aggie jokes? Aggie is Texas A&M, which is a university in Texas which has an unfortunate reputation. And the one funny Aggie joke that I know is about the agronomy professor at Texas A&M who spent 30 years of his life producing a seedless pecan. Right? But the point of this question, of course, is that the seedless things were presumably propagated by grafting. Is that unnatural? So what's the answer? Are you entitled to describe food produced by cloning as natural? And what's the question we've got to ask to answer that? As in the previous case. Isn't the question we have to ask why people care? Right? Because, again, if the reason they care is that they are worried about pesticide residues, well, the fact that it came from a cloned plant doesn't make it any more likely to have pesticide residues than anything else, so that's irrelevant. If the reason they care is that they believe that naturally evolved things are better for us than artificially created things, well, then clone plants are still all right because the genetics evolved naturally. It's just the method of production that's unnatural, although somebody might have some theory in which that wasn't true. On the other hand, if that second one is the argument, then you could say that genetically engineered plants do need a warning if people sincerely believe that somehow natural evolution produces better things. Yeah?
How many people have to care before you require a
plant? Yeah. But it seems to me that his answer is probably in the right direction, as in the previous case. Either a whole lot of people have to care a little, or a few people have to care a lot. Yeah?
But isn't that getting easier, though, if everyone has a phone that has a barcode scanner on it, so you just have every single thing that's in it and have nothing on the actual package about what's in it? But you just program in your peanuts, shrimp, meat, or whatever else, and scan it, and it would red flag your...
This is reminding me of the problem I had when my children were much younger, and part of the deal was that every night I put my daughter to bed, I had to make up three stories for her. And they were what I think of as extruded fantasy products, sort of generic fantasy stories. And the problem was that she remembered them much better than I did. And so I would have the same experience I'm having here, that I get one of the characters into some really difficult situation that makes a good story. And she says, but Daddy, that magical device they got 3 months ago, that'll get them out of that with no trouble at all. And there goes my story. You people keep insisting on trying to introduce modern technology in order to mess up the puzzles that I'm trying to set to you. But of course, one answer will be that you may all be techies, but it's a little risky to assume that everybody who buys anything in a grocery store is a techie. And it's true that by now most people have cell phones, in this country at least. In fact, I think the number of cell phones in the world is, I think, well over 50% of the world population at this point, so it's pretty high. But not all of those are smartphones, and not all of the smartphones will have the software you're talking about. Now, a counter-argument could be, yes, but if you really care about some uncommon issue, you'll take the precaution of having that. So maybe that's an adequate response. I don't know.
Right.
Yeah? No. If someone in... Oh, why don't we have... Crystal, read Crystal's case.
Does it really depend on the genetically modified part? That is, suppose I am growing a crop of some particular variety of fruit or vegetable or whatever, and my plant's being pollinized by different strains of the same species, it means they won't produce what I want. wouldn't that really be the same issue?
If someone intentionally
cross-pollinating. Well, in your case, I wasn't assuming that they were intentionally polluting your field. I was assuming they were intentionally growing the genetically modified crop in their field and the wind blew the pollen around.
No,
you're assuming. You're assuming they're actually targeting it somehow. I see. Yeah, that does seem more like a tort issue than a regulatory issue, right? Because you've got a single objective. I'm not quite sure anybody would do that, but I suppose anybody could do anything.
I was thinking of it in terms of, I think people that maybe have objections about genetically modified food, they would view it as certainly a trespass of some sort.
No, but the people on the other side aren't planting their crop in order to get your field pollinated by it. They're planting their crop in order to get their field pollinated by it, right? So I'm not sure what the incentive would be to deliberately pollute someone else's field as an objective as opposed to as a side effect of something else you were doing. Yeah, maybe. I mean, or a spite case where, you know, you hate somebody because, you know, his daughter refused to marry your son or something. You could imagine cases of that sort, I suppose. But again, I'm just wondering, I bet that there are cases related to this with animals. Because think about the case where you've got a prize mare that you're planning to have artificially inseminated from some suitable stallion. And somehow your neighbor's stallion gets loose, and lo and behold, your mare is pregnant by some very inferior sire. And I bet that at some point in the history of animal breeding, some case like that has happened and been litigated. Anything that seems likely? Could be wrong. It sounds like the sort of thing that would really happen, because that's a case where, much more than plant breeding, they do control, you know, how the breeding is done in a very detailed way, and it's worth a lot of money. That a foal with the appropriate sire, I suppose, could probably sell for many, many thousands of dollars. Yes. Yeah, no, it would be. I was just thinking of what's the nearest case where you might have real precedent. all right, this is one which sort of amused me, and again, I think is an interesting general issue which just comes up here. The Prince of Wales waded into the biotech debate a few years ago, vowing in a column in the Daily Telegraph that he would never eat or serve to his guests the fruits of a technology that takes mankind into realms that belong to God and to God alone. And in the chapter that you read for this, I had a quote from Islamic literature about somebody quoting, I think, the Prophet as basically saying things which, if he had known about biotech, might have been an attack on biotech, saying that, you know, no man can do these things, only God can do these things. And in fact, I've been told that one basis for the prohibition among some Muslims against pictures of living creatures is a tradition that on the Day of Judgment, if you have made a picture of a living creature, the picture will be put in front of you and will be asked to make it move, to make it come alive. Failing to do so, you demonstrate that you were pretending to a power that only God has to make living creatures, and that to hell with you, essentially, or some version of that. So, anyway, does it follow that regulation of agricultural biotech would in the U.S. violate the First Amendment? Or to generalize it, how does one make that judgment an issue where the regulation can be and is defended on both religious and secular grounds? And we can think of lots of issues, obviously, other than biotech, where that's a pretty hot issue even today. So anybody have an opinion on whether the First Amendment does or doesn't restrict us in making laws whose motive is religious?
I'm sorry, but I don't quite understand the question, to be honest.
Sure. Suppose somebody wants to ban genetically modified organisms. Mm-hmm. And you say to him, why do you want to ban them? And he says, because they violate God's will. Can I say, sorry, bud, we're not allowed to establish religion, and if you ban something because it violates what your religion says is God's will, you're establishing religion?
I don't think that will happen.
You don't think that'll work?
You have to have some kind of real
Well, the tangible negative consequence to banning. Oh, I see. So wait a minute. Which side are you saying? You're saying that I'm going to be able to get the court to throw out his ban, or that if that was his argument. When you say you can't bring up the argument, I'm not quite sure what you mean by that.
You'll have to have, I mean, that may be a motivation, but that can't be a sword, of course.
How do you find this out? That is, for a moment, the federal constitution really restricts what the federal government can do in two quite different ways, which is one of the things that's before the court at the moment. One of them, and I think arguably the original one, is by saying, here is the list of things Congress can do and can't do anything else. And the other, which was the basis of the Bill of Rights, is here are the list of things Congress can't do. All right. Now, one could see on the first, on the idea of specific powers, saying if your only reason for making this law is to avoid offending God, and if nowhere in the Constitution does it say Congress has the right to avoid offending God, you can't do it. But I'm not sure. The problem is can you stretch the no law respecting the establishment of religion far enough? Let me take a different case which has come up and seemed to me was rather silly. And that's people who seem to be arguing that there's something unconstitutional about raising the fact that Romney is a Mormon. And it seems to me that has to be wrong. That is to say that it isn't an establishment of religion to say vote for or against this guy because of his religion. Right? It would be an establishment. They quote, there's not supposed to be a religious test, but there isn't a religious test. The test is going to get the votes. And so it's not clear to me where in principle you draw a line. Now, as a practical matter, of course, anything anybody wants to do, they can always find non-religious arguments. I mean, you think about it, the lively cases are not the GM one. The lively cases are abortion and gay marriage. That those are both cases, or contraception for that matter as well, that those are cases where clearly one important motive for the opponents was that their religion opposed these things. But at the same time, any lawyer worth his salt can think up non-religious reasons why abortion should be illegal, or why contraception should be illegal, or why gay marriage should be illegal. You know, it's a big world, and you can always find arguments. But so do people, in fact, think that... what if both sides are religious? What if one side says you mayn't do this because God will be angry, and says you must do this or God will be angry? You can certainly think of a little effort. We could think of some examples of that. Now we can't have the argument at all. This is like my view of the precautionary principle, which is that in many cases, the precautionary principle both bans doing something and not doing it, since either of them might have some terrible consequence. Is people's opinion that if the only argument you can offer... Do you have to offer arguments for things? I guess that's part of the question. Suppose Congressman says, I'm going to introduce a bill to do X. My bill declares that consuming vitamin C in more than 500, in units above such and such, is illegal. Where in the legal system is he required to give an argument for it? Right? If a regular agency wanted to do it, they have a statute which says what they can do. But where is the restriction? What's your argument? He says, the argument for it is I got the votes to do it. But the challenge is then going to be on the grounds that the Constitution only gives Congress certain specific powers?
You would think so.
But of course, we know that one of those powers is the regulation of interstate commerce, and as the administration is about to argue, that covers everything you can imagine, right? I mean, that's in a sense been true since Millard, Philburn, since the the agriculture case, which Wickard v. Fulbright, that's it, Wickard, thank you, which is the case that holds that growing crops to feed your own animals is interstate can be regulated under regulation of interstate commerce. So,
what? Why didn't see those issues early?
So you're going to have to make an interstate commerce argument, but that's, yeah. The under current law, the DSHEA, which is the dietary supplements, I forget the rest of it. I did look. What? You remember?
Just kind of health something else.
Yeah, health something. Act is the A, but I forget the rest. Dietary supplements and drugs face different regulatory rules. How would a genetically engineered herb designed for some desirable effect on health fit into that system? So do people know what the distinction is between dietary supplements? I was looking it up on the web and after I looked at this question. And drugs is? As far as I can tell, it's mostly a matter of claims. That a dietary supplement isn't supposed to claim to cure any disease or ailment. But it isn't clear to me in terms of... Yeah? It's an odd way of putting it, though, because, of course, vitamins do claim to affect it. Yes, right. But it seems to me that I don't remember why I originally invented this question, but that the requirements don't specify how it's created. That is to say, there are going to be some medical drugs under FDA, which are natural products, where, you know, you... certainly there are recreational drugs. Marijuana is a natural product. Cocaine is a processed natural product and so forth. So I'm not sure how the question of how you produce it is really going to feed into this. You could imagine, you could say, well, suppose we've got a prescription drug and I genetically engineer a crop to produce that drug. But I suspect the answer is, in theory, if I claim that it changes anything, then it's a drug. And in practice, I think the FDA will say we already know it's a drug, and therefore it's under the regulation. Take the next one, which, like many of these, covers a lot of stuff beyond our subject. Suppose genetic testing develops to the point where employers routinely look at a variety of genetic characteristics in deciding whether to hire someone. Different racial groups have different distributions of some genetic characteristics. If an employer uses genetic criteria that are met by 60% of whites and 50% of blacks, is he guilty of racial discrimination? Anybody?
I think the argument, it's not just racial discrimination. There's a new type of discrimination. There's genetic discrimination.
I don't think anywhere in the civil rights law.
But that might be the next.
You might have a law against it.
Yeah.
And what would the argument be for a law against it?
Just like you're not born with what race you are, or where you're from, you're not born with what... I mean, sorry, you're not... it's unfair to make us suspect that.
How about the blatant discrimination by basketball teams in hiring against short people? All right. Being short is not, I mean, I would like to say I chose to be short. There are clearly great advantages to being short, but I have to confess it's all in my genes, just purely accidental.
Height is a bona fide occupational requirement.
Ha. Very good. So for a moment, this question is not really start with genetic testing, because there has been litigation over other ways of selecting employees which had disparate racial impact. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that in theory at least, the critical question is whether you are testing for something that's really relevant to doing the job. So that if I understand the situation, if I am testing people for a job that involves physically picking things up and moving them, a physical test of upper body strength is legitimate, even though many more men than women will pass it. On the other hand, if I'm hiring people for a sedentary activity, a test which mostly men and not women will pass is going to count as illegitimate because it's discriminatory, right? So similarly for the genetics, the real question will be, what evidence do you have that this is a that the genetic characteristics you're looking for are actually relevant to performance.
Isn't there a new gene that
was figured out
a couple years ago, the Genetic Something Discrimination Act?
Tell me about it.
I don't remember exactly. It's something a couple years ago that the president signed in, just because, I mean, they are using more and more genetic.
But was that about insurance companies or employees?
For insurance companies, and it's also for employment.
And so what does it say? You don't know.
I don't know. I don't remember exactly. I mean, I think it's sort of prevent something. This is to prevent genetic information. Obviously, with healthcare, it's really easy to scrape it up. I don't know how it ties to employment, but I know employment is also covered. Because I think this is like a real scenario that we're worried about coming up with minority. I don't know. Well, I don't remember.
Yeah. As people have been arguing for quite a long time, I remember a talk probably more than a decade ago, that insurance companies shouldn't be allowed to use genetic testing, and I think we already discussed the problems that that rule raises.
It's called the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act.
Right.
And, I mean, I don't know the details, but,
yes,
but it's for health insurance and employment as well.
Yes, right. Right. So
I think it's like a real problem.
But I guess in a sense, the question then would be, what if the genetic information is relevant? And I think for health insurance, they'll say, well, then you certainly can't use it. Maybe I can look it up, or somebody can look it up and see just what it says, because you could certainly imagine cases. Suppose you've got a genetic susceptibility to some particular chemical, and we're hiring people to do work where they risk being exposed to that chemical. It would seem perfectly reasonable that you don't want people who are susceptible to it. All right, next one. If genetic testing could determine lifespan and intelligence at birth, should a child who is likely to live long and be extremely bright be afforded better educational and health resources than a child who is likely to die young and have only average intelligence, since the former will benefit society more in the long term? Do we already do this to a certain degree? Comments? To begin with, I don't know who we is. Certainly I would do it, and I think all parents do it, right? Imagine that the case of a family which is on the margin of being able to send its kid to college. Which kid do they send to college? They send to college probably the one they think can best profit by it. So imagine they have two sons, one of whom is very bright and studious and so forth, and the other is sort of lazy and a little bit dumb. They're going to send the bright one to college, right? So, yep.
The dumb one to college too, like it's smart and get serious and buckle down kind of thing.
You might depend on your interpretation of those.
The kids want, and the more studious ones want, they want to go to college.
That's also true, but as I'm considering the case where they're poor enough so that it's not a plausible option to send both of them, and it seems to me that it's always been the case that families allocate their resources to their kids in a way reflecting how well they think the kids can use the resources. To take a particularly extreme case, going back to my other seminar, as you may know, Imperial China invented the civil service exam. That Imperial China had a system for going way back where the way you got government office was by passing a very difficult exam, which was basically in things like, did you know the classic literature? Could you compose poetry? Stuff of that sort. It's a crazy system, except the society lasted for a long time, so maybe it worked. But in any case, I gather that it was not uncommon if in a village there was one unusually bright kid for the villagers to all chip in to pay the cost of getting him the education that with luck could get him through that exam, give him maybe a low-level civil service position, which he could then use to help benefit the members of his village and his family and such. But what about going beyond parents? How about other institutions of society? Do we, in fact, favorably take education rather than healthcare for a moment. We'll get to healthcare in a moment. But for education, do we, in fact, favor smart people over dumb people? Yeah.
I mean, in most public schools, they have I remember I grew up in Utah, it's called ELP, the Extended Learning Program, where they had alternative schools where if you perform better within that ELP that was in a regular public school, they would send you to a better public schools, so it certainly happens.
Now, that could be. You would imagine a tracking system where you spent the same resources on everybody, it's just that you gave a different instruction. But my guess is that's not true. Now, it's complicated in our case because you also spend more resources on kids who are believed to have learning disabilities and such. So it could go both ways. But what I was actually thinking of was the very common pattern of merit-based scholarships. That it's common, I think both, I don't know if I'll say universities, but I bet state universities do it too, but certainly private universities, that some money to aid education is given just to the kids who they think are smartest. And that's clearly a, unfair, but it clearly is a case of what's being described. So then you could imagine the genetic equivalent. Let us suppose that I am a generous billionaire and I want America to be a successful society. And I say, what does it take for America to be a successful society? That the very smartest kids get the best education. So what do I do? Assuming, let's suppose that we're in a society that already has genetic testing of every newborn to look for other things. And so I get access to the data and I say, I want to find the 1,000th percent of the kids who on a genetic basis are going to be smartest. And once I've found those kids, I'm going to offer money to their parents to be used to give them various additional forms of education, starting when they're quite little, before anything other than genetics would have spotted it. In order, maybe if their parents are really poor, some of the money can subsidize nutrition. You could think of various things of that sort. All right, you could certainly imagine that. I don't think it would be illegal under any rules. People for or against it? Is it a good or a bad idea? Suppose you
for
it.
Because it's a private individual, but if it was the person lobbying for allocation of resources, then.
But for it in the sense that you will take the billionaire out to dinner, that you will approve of him as a good guy. Right. As you may know, there is a billionaire who is paying people not to go to college.
Yeah,
Peter Thiel. But that's a different project. Also an interesting project. Interesting guy. How about medical? Can you think of an equivalent decision that is routinely made on a medical basis, indeed, which has recently, very recently, raised a bit of a controversy. Yeah.
Sorry, this is a separate example, but I think it's analogous with just sports in public schools and things like that. Well, it's not necessarily the criteria isn't intelligence. Certainly,
yep.
You have kids where there are private schools that will pull the best kids from poor areas into their school strictly to play sports. These kids go to college. These kids.
It's a little tricky in a way, that particular example, because the question is, are you spending money on them because you'll produce good sports figures, or are you really hiring them? Is it that they have a marketable skill and you're just paying them a concealed salary for playing for your
right.
for your school, which isn't quite the same case here. Yeah. I think that was done in the Soviet Union as well, as I understand it, in some of the Eastern European countries. For the health case, yeah? That's what I was thinking of. That the particular case is that Cheney just got a heart. Various people who don't like him have been saying, you know, like the Tin Woodman, he now finally has a heart. But to which my response is, you're unlikely to know him well enough to know if he's really a bad person or just someone whose politics disagree with yours, because it's too easy to confuse the two. But in any case, part of the controversy is that Cheney is fairly old, and it is at least asserted that being old is normally a contraindication for heart transplants, and. The rebuttal to that is it's not really old, it's really being infirm, and he was in very good health, and so forth. It may or may not be true. But it certainly is true, if I think for a moment of the British health service, that their allocation of scarce medical resources used to, and I presume still does, explicitly say, in effect, we don't want to waste resources on somebody who's going to die of something else in 5 years anyway. So therefore, my impression is that there are a variety of things, such as kidney transplants and such, which you were unlikely to get if you were past some age. So I think in practice, the answer is that without genetic testing, we do all of these things. And for many of them, the argument for saying it's unfair because it wasn't your fault is just as good as for the genetics. Some of them it isn't. You can say, well, your kidney went bad because you drank too much or something. Liver, I guess, gets bad. Something goes bad if you drink too much anyway. On an entirely different subject, just mentioning drinking too much. Something that struck me recently, I was listening, there's a satellite radio program of doctors talking. And they were discussing the question of alcohol and health. And all of them agreed that the evidence showed that moderate alcohol consumption was good for you. I don't know if it's true, but they all seemed to think it was clear that something on the order of, I think, one beer for women and one or two beers for men, I assume because men are bigger on average than women, or the equivalent of other things, made you healthier. All of them agreed that they would not advise their patients to do it. And it struck me, maybe unfairly, that what was really going on was not the medical judgment that the risk that they'll drink too much is too high, because if you imagine someone you're advising to do this, he's presumably somebody who isn't drinking, which is why you have to advise him, and, you know, only a small fraction of people have the genetics for alcoholism. I think what's going on is more a sort of a social pressure or a professional social pressure. Everybody knows alcohol is bad. Therefore, if it's good, you should keep the fact quiet, because, you know, that sort of clashes. I was struck by sort of a similar pattern in the whole global warming dispute, which is that anytime you see a scientific study which implies a weaker case for doing things about global warming than previously existed, it always includes a disclaimer by the scientists saying, but of course global warming is a terrible thing, we've got to take precautions against it. And again, my suspicion, though I may be wrong, is that what's going on is a sort of we've got to show we're good guys and not bad guys. We know what's the side of good. And I think that's true for both of those cases. And probably for a lot of other cases. The example I gave before about butter versus margarine is a pretty striking case where, in a sense, the expert consensus was dangerously wrong. And diet, of course, as you may know, has been a hot issue for a long, long time where you have these various people who claim that some dietary rule quite different than what's being advised is really the good one. And for all I know, they may be right. My elder son is on a Paleo 2 diet. Paleo starts out with the idea that we evolved in the Paleolithic period to eat certain things, and therefore eating other things is likely to be bad for us, which is plausible conjecture, might not be true. And Paleo 2 isn't quite that, but it's sort of a more developed version. And theoretically what it comes from, I don't know how good the evidence is, was somebody who studied various primitive peoples, some of whom were still eating their traditional diet and some of whom had switched to a modern diet, and claimed that there were certain medical problems that were much more common in the second group, and that provided evidence that there was some feature of the modern diet that was causing, I think, diabetes is one of them. I don't remember what the others are. How good the evidence is, I don't know. But that is a case where there is sort of a conventional view, and then there are the ones, the fringe, and I'm suspicious of sort of officially true science, as it were, that sometimes it's right, sometimes it isn't right. It's an interesting tendency, though. You can see that there's always a tendency. You see that with global warming and with a number of other issues to try to get the National Academy of Science to make a statement, and they would say, aha, that's official truth. Now if you argue against it, you're an ignorant nutcase. Which is a nice thing to be able to say to people who disagree with you. You can get away with it. All right. How should intellectual property law adjust as progress in biotechnology makes the process more like engineering and less like plant breeding? All right, there is, as you may know, there are plant patents. But the plant patents, as I understand it, are not covering an idea, which is what patents are supposed to protect. They're covering essentially a strain of plants. And, for example, should the law recognize a patent on an idea in plant or animal design, a way of modifying the organism to produce some desirable feature? So suppose somebody figures out how to genetically modify plants to change the color of their flowers. Could be very valuable in the rose industry. All right? Can he patent not his variety of black roses, but the knowledge that if you insert the following sequence of amino acids or DNA bases or whatever it is, DNA bases, into the DNA of a rose in the following place, that will give you black, and that will give you purple, and that will give you red, and here's our... Can he patent that? Anybody else?
I think so. So we have process patent on discovery of how to do that.
And the process, would it have to be on the mechanics of how you insert it, or could somebody else say, well, I inserted the same things you said to insert, but I did it by using a different technology?
Is that might be a very strong patent. It could be done in a different way.
So you think it would have to be the way of inserting rather than the idea, which is ultimately genetic knowledge? Yeah?
Does it actually work?
Assuming it works. I'm assuming it works. He's got, after in order to get his patent, he's got to have reduced it to practice, and that usually, though not always, means he has to have done it.
Okay.
As you may know, there is I forget what it's called, but it's something like a theoretical reduction to practice that now is sometimes possible, but it's not the
first to conceive.
And novelty, and yeah, but so take biowarfare. It's an interesting one. I looked up the protocol. Under the Geneva Convention and the later Biological Weapons Convention, all forms of biological warfare are banned. Are there good reasons to treat biological warfare differently from other ways of killing people? Would those reasons still apply to much more sophisticated versions? For instance, a disease designed to burn itself out in a certain length of time or number of generations, giving it an effective range of, say, only about 100 miles from where it started. Yeah?
I would just say the duration of just not being certain of what's going to happen with this disease that you're unleashing on the world is certainly a concern.
So,
it's also just how you think about war, too. If your ultimate goal is to eradicate your enemy, then maybe no. But if realistically it's to kind of bang this out until we can open up the lines of communication again, then permitting them to just put a disease in where unleash a disease on the population and potentially eradicate them probably isn't.
There's one could certainly see the argument, although as far as I can tell, it doesn't appear, at least in the stuff I could find on the convention, that there's a terrible danger to third parties, that you start the disease and it'll spread. But I noticed that it also forbids toxins, which are, I believe, basically poisons associated with organisms, and those wouldn't spread. Yeah?
I think as opposed to something like, you know, maybe an explosive device that would redesign, you know, as a reaction to that, that is now, you can predict its conclusion much better than...
You're not familiar with Murphy's Law? If something can go wrong, it will?
Yeah. Well, it gives it more...
Yes. Yeah. No. I can certainly see an argument of saying that the dangers of biological warfare to third parties are large, and at least unless we know an awful lot more than we do, that you may not trust the scientist who tells you it'll burn itself out in 100 miles, because what if it mutates during that period and mutates away from whatever is limiting it? That's obviously a serious worry. If I actually, yeah. I think England drafted the original text, if I've got that right.
Because this is something that benefits larger countries that have more resources for things like conventional bombs.
Might, though they might also have more resources for biological research. But... No, but it's an interesting idea that at this point it's been signed by a lot of countries, but there are no enforcement mechanisms, in fact, so you don't really know if people are actually obeying it who signed it, as far as I can tell. The two arguments that I saw just Googling around at it, and one of the arguments was that it was sort of a first step towards general disarmament, that it was sort of a part of the usual idea of war is bad, let's reduce the amount of damage done, and in particular disarmament from weapons of mass destruction, and the other one was, quote, mitigating the horrors of war. And as you may know, the attempt to ban the crossbow was not entirely successful, although it was presumably done on somewhat similar grounds. The On the other hand, one point which occurred to me, and which is relevant to some current issues having nothing to do with biological warfare, is that there's sort of a trade-off to mitigating the horrors of war. There's a quote from Robert E. Lee: "It is well that war should be so horrible, else we would become too fond of it." Which was, I thought, an interesting line from a very successful general. And you can see in general that the trade-off is that the more you make war unhorrible, the more tempting it is to engage in it. And I was actually thinking of a different issue, but a current issue, which is the use of tasers. That if you think of any form of sort of non-lethal form forced by police, that on the one hand, there's the obvious argument in favor of it, that you have some kind of a clash and somebody doesn't get killed. But the argument on the other side is, since the police know that people probably won't be killed, they're much more willing to use it, and sometimes people do get killed, even if not intentionally. And you can imagine a similar trade-off here, where somebody on the other side could say, there's actually, I think, a Pratchett novel, for anybody who reads Terry Pratchett, who I recommend because he's sometimes very good, in which the ruler of the city of Ankh-Morpork has in his palace that world's equivalent of Leonardo da Vinci, Leonardo of Quirm, who is this super genius inventor who is very, very impractical and doesn't mind being, in effect, a prisoner in the palace because, you know, the ruler gives him everything he wants. And at one point, Leonardo of Quirm has thought up the atomic bomb. And he thinks it's a great idea. It's really useful for, you know, moving mountains and things. And nobody would ever use it for warfare. I mean, it would be so horrible, it would just end all warfare. And, you know, he's a little optimistic on that, as it turns out. But you can see the form of that argument is a real argument. Bioengineers have already created transgenic plants and animals which possess certain advantageous traits. What if they could create versions of endangered species that could withstand the environmental pollution destruction that was causing their extinction? Should such plants and animals count as to whether a species is entitled to protection under the Endangered Species Act? Anybody? Yeah?
So as long as there's not a lot of them.
What do you mean, not a lot of them?
Well, endangered species is an indication of a quantity.
No, but this is turning it around. This is saying, should you say the species is not endangered?
Yeah, there's still only 10 of this species.
Oh, I see. But if the reason it was endangered was some pollutant that killed it, and if we now have a variant of the species which is immune to that pollutant, so after a while there are lots of the variants running around, now can we say the species isn't endangered? Yeah?
I thought about this when I saw that the pigs got endangered species, they started to clone them in captivity. So not necessarily the improved characteristics, but obviously depopulating and going to some extent. And I thought it was a neat idea in terms of like the keeping the numbers around to populate, but I think it's a slippery slope in terms of letting the human intervention or harm go unchecked because we've figured out that altered solution.
But why do you call it harm if our solution means it no longer harms things?
I can't put my finger on it. There's just something that seems wrong about the method.
In that instance, what happens when you clone them and now the majority of that species, whatever small population it has, is now clones, and you try to start breeding them, and where does their gene pool go at this point?
But their gene pool is already small. The same thing would happen if you weren't using cloning. Once the population is funneled down, if you use ordinary reproduction, you'll also get a small gene pool. But of course, if you only clone from a few individuals, you'll get it even narrower. But again, I want to claim that we're back where we were with labeling, that the question is, why do you care about endangered species? Because if the reason you care... there are sort of a bunch of different arguments there that I've seen. One argument which I don't find very plausible, but it's possible, is they look, each species has biological information in it. It might turn out that the species we wiped out is the one from which we could have learned how to cure AIDS. And my temptation is, well, in that case, we've got a really simple solution. All we got to do is to take a specimen, freeze it, And once we know enough to actually use the information, we can then analyze the DNA. We can even clone some new individuals from the frozen tissue. So why worry about keeping it alive? But in general, that struck me for a long time as implausible. A different argument is the ecological argument. The argument which says, look, you have this complicated interdependent system. Pull out one piece of it. Who knows what will happen? Therefore, we don't want to pull out pieces. And then the answer to this question would be, does the modified version of the species play the same role in the ecology? If the only effect of the modification is that gasoline fumes in the Los Angeles air don't kill it, fine, it'll continue doing whatever it did, so that solves the problem, not an endangered species. But there might be other reasons, and I suspect a good deal of the sort of gut-level feeling on endangered species is something like deer or cute. It's something like that you like the idea of there being living creatures. Well, you might or might not say it fits if there's a slightly variant version. You might say I still like it. Now, almost nobody seems to think that smallpox disease is cute. All right, that's an endangered species, all right? We've done our very best to endanger it. Although in principle, I suppose, you would think it was covered by the same things. And people who live in suburban areas where there are a lot of deer have stopped thinking of deer as cute. We used to think of deer as cute for a long time, especially ones who want to grow fruit trees. Particularly unhappy about deer. Right. All right, well, I think our time is done. Yes. If you're doing one for the,
no.
You're not doing it. In that case, I will be happy to look at an outlaw line if you want me to. But all I need is a fine. At some point when you have a draft, it would be nice to see it. But,
okay.
But I don't think I need an outline.
Okay.